So, welcome everybody. Today's sutta is called the Salayaka Sutta, the Brahmins of Sala. And on the surface, it appears like a very kind of simple sutta. It's a sutta about the basically about morality and immorality, or what is might be called in Buddhism wholesome and unwholesome actions. But as with many of these suttas that are kind of simple on the surface, there's always a lot of things in these things that don't actually, you know, stand out on first sight. So once you start to look at the sutta in a bit of depth, there's actually quite a lot of interesting information in here as well, as there usually is in these suttas. Yes? It's in page 379. Yeah. Majjhima 41. So I'll just start, and we'll just see what happens as we go along. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was wandering by stages in the Kosalan country with a large sangha of bhikkhus, and eventually he arrived at the Kosalan Brahmin village named Sala. The Brahmin householders of Sala heard the recluse Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth from a Sakyan clan, has been wandering in the Kosalan country with a large sangha of bhikkhus and has come to Sala. Now a good report of Master Gotama has been spread to this effect. The Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of the worlds, incomparable leaders of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. He declares this world with its gods, its maras and its brahmas, this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, its princes and its people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. He teaches the Dhamma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing. And he reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. Now it is good to see such arahants. So this is like a standard opening you see in many, many different suttas across the Pali Canon, and I don't know how much emphasis should be put on these things, but just basically talking about the reputation that the Buddha had at this time. And you see at the bottom there the people saying, oh, it's good to see such arahants. But obviously these people weren't Buddhists. They arahants, obviously, here is a word that was in common use in India at the time. And the word arahant just means somebody who is worthy. It's from the root of a word that means worthy. So basically they're saying he's a worthy one. In other words, he's worthy of respect, he's worthy of offerings and all these kind of things. He's a worthy person, basically. That's what it meant. So he's like a spiritual leader who is worthy of these things. And then it continues. This next one is also a standard passage that you see in many different places. And it's actually missing in the Chinese parallel to this sutta. So again, one wonders whether these things, they're just to give, I think, a sense of the setting of the sutta. Then the Brahmin householders of Sala went to the Blessed One. Some paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down at one side. Some exchanged greetings with him, and when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, sat down at one side. Some extended their hands in reverential salutation towards the Blessed One and sat down at one side. Some pronounced their name and clan in the Blessed One's presence and sat down at one side. Some kept silent and sat down at one side. So, yeah. If you have any questions as we go along, just please just raise your hand as we go through this. When they were seated, they said to the Blessed One, Master Gotama, what is the cause and condition why some beings here under dissolution of the body after death reappear in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell? And what is the cause and condition why some beings here under dissolution of the body after death reappear in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world? So this was a standard view at this time at the Buddha. It wasn't all pervasive. there were people who were saying that there were no such thing as a rebirth and reincarnation in the future. But it seemed to have been a common view at the time of the Buddha. And of course, once you believe in an idea of an afterlife, well, you want to know how to make the most of that afterlife. It makes good sense. So the Buddha replies, householders, it is by reason of conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma, by reason of unrighteous conduct, that some beings here on the dissolution of the body after death reappear in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. It is by reason of conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, by reason of righteous conduct, that some beings here on the dissolution of the body after death reappear in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. So here, what you see here is that it is conduct that is good in general that leads to a happy state in the future. Sometimes you will hear in Buddhist circles that if you keep the five precepts, then you are, it's almost like a ticket to a happy rebirth. But that is not actually what the Buddha is saying here. What he's saying is that it's generally good conduct. And this good conduct, as we will see soon, actually extends beyond the five precepts. It's the whole a kind of breadth, the whole specter of good conduct that is actually included in this. So that is one thing to keep, it's a small thing to keep in mind. And then the Sala, householders of Sala, the Brahmins of Sala, they respond, we do not understand the detailed meaning of Master Gotama's utterance, which he has spoken in brief, without expounding the detailed meaning. It would be good if Master Gotama would teach us the Dhamma so that we might understand the detailed meaning of his utterance. Then, householders, listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, Venerable Sir, they replied, the Blessed One said this. Householder, there are three kinds of bodily conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma, unrighteous conduct. There are four kinds of verbal conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma, unrighteous conduct. There are three kinds of mental conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma, unrighteous conduct. So these here, if you count them up, this is altogether 10 different things. There's three bodily acts, if you like, four verbal ways of acting, and then three mental ways of acting. So there's 10 altogether. And these 10 altogether is a standard set you find throughout the suttas. And they're called like the 10 ways of right, of like wholesome action. And the opposite is the 10 ways of unwholesome action. And this is like the Buddha's most detailed explanation, in a sense, of morality, of virtue, how to actually practice morality. And for this reason, it actually is quite useful because it really specifies the whole range of morality in this way. And of course, one of the important things here, which is very important in the Buddhist teaching, is that conduct is not just conduct of body and speech, but also conduct of mind. So mental morality is a very important aspect of the Buddha's teachings. It's not just outward, but also the inward conduct that is important. And this is, I think, one of the things which makes the Buddha's teaching quite unique in some ways. And one of the things that we will see as we go through this, you may remember that the way morality is defined elsewhere, the way it is defined is often that if you're coming from defilement, if you have a defiled mind and you act motivated by a defiled mind, anger, greed, delusion, these kind of things, that is what is usually considered bad karma, right? If you act from defilement. If you act from lack of defilement, if you act from compassion, from kind of non-greed and clarity of mind, then that is what is called good karma in Buddhism. So when we go through these 10 ways, it's important to keep this in mind as we go through this, that each of these things that are called morality here, actually in the end, is the mental state behind it that really is important. And this is one of the things I want to point out when we look at this, because once you realize that, it actually puts another light on this idea of what is true goodness and what is really badness in Buddhism. And you start to understand that there's a lot of nuances within these categories, within these precepts, if you like. nuances are actually is all what it's about, precisely because the mind can be so varied, you have an almost infinite amount of nuance in how these things can be kept or not kept. Another thing to keep in mind, the other way that morality is often defined in the suttas, is often defined in the sense that if you do something that leads to another person's harm, affliction, pain, unpleasantness, your own harm, pain, affliction, or the affliction of both, then that again is the bad act. If it is the opposite, it doesn't lead to that, then it's a good act. And this again is something to keep in the back of your mind as we read through this, because these are like the basic foundation principles of Buddhist morality, and they apply in all of these instances. So we'll see this as we go through this. So the Buddha then, having said the summary, that there are three kinds of bodily bad conduct, four kinds of unwholesome verbal conduct, and three kinds of unwholesome mental conduct, then he goes on to enumerate each one of these. And how, householders, are there three kinds of bodily conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma, unrighteous conduct? Here, someone kills living beings. He is murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, merciless to living beings. So here, you recognize this as being very similar to the first precept. The first precept, not to kill beings, right? But you will also notice that it's not exactly the same as the first precept. There are certain differences here between this one and the first precept. And the first one is that this one, instead of just saying killing living beings, it also adds this line, given to blows and violence. And these words in Pali basically means violence. It could mean death, it could mean anything really. But it shows you that the way, if you are merciless to living beings, it's not just killing that is bad. Obviously, any kind of maltreatment is included in this. And this is what this one is saying here. It's actually broader than just killing. It's any kind of bad treatment of others is obviously inappropriate. And then comes maybe the most important one here, which says something about the mind state of this person. He is merciless to living beings, right? This is a very important qualifier, because this brings us back to what I was just saying before. Actually, it is your motivation, the intention of your mind, that is really important. You have a state of mind that is merciless. You're not coming from compassion. You're not coming from wisdom. You're not coming from kindness. You're coming from being merciless. And that is really what is the problem here. So if you are merciless, that is when the killing or the kind of the oppressing of other beings is bad. But say that there was such a thing as killing where you weren't being merciless. You were coming from compassion instead. You were coming from kindness. What then? Would it then be covered by this precept or this unwholesome way of conduct? And the answer is, if you look at this one, the answer seems to be no. It's not actually covered by this. So if killing comes from compassion, if it comes from understanding, if it comes from the right point of view, then you may actually be, it may actually not be against this particular precept, if you like. And you can see here how the difference here between this very nuanced and balanced way of explaining the first precept and the way the first precept normally is explained, you shouldn't kill living beings, there's a big difference there. The first precept, as it's normally explained, is a very broad category. It's not very refined. It's a very kind of coarse. It's just something to guide you on the path on every day, in everyday life, so you don't actually go too far wrong. But it doesn't actually give you the nuanced morality that you find in places like this. And actually, it's not just the killing, but it's how you do these things is actually even more important than the killing itself. I'll get back to this, the implications of this statement, a little bit later on when we go to the positive side of things. So that is the first bad a way of bodily conduct. And then we have the second one. He takes what is not given. He takes by way of theft the wealth and property of others in the village or forest. So again here, he takes what is not given. In other words, he steals. He takes by way of theft. And this is maybe the important point here. It's, in other words, you do something that is considered theft by way of theft here. Another way of translating it, this is to say something that is considered or reckoned as theft in society. So it is, if it's reckoned as theft, then it's bad. But again, there might be instances where you actually are coming from the right place. Maybe you are stealing or taking something for the right reasons. And I want to get back to this afterwards to see if there might be such cases. Then he misconducts himself in sensual pleasures. He has intercourse with women who are protected by their mother and father, brother, sister, or relatives, who have a husband, who are protected by the law, and even with those who are garlanded in token of betrothal. And this particular precept or unwholesome way of conduct is also quite interesting, because what you are seeing here basically is that these factors that are mentioned here, that you are protected by these people, these are basically social norms, right? Whether you are considered protected by somebody, whether you are considered somebody who is kind of, society doesn't really approve of having certain relationships with these people. If you're protected in this way, that will depend on the norms in the particular society. This will vary from society to society. And that is interesting, because what that means, that this particular precept actually is one that depends on the society you're in. What does it mean to be protected by society? And in India in those days, obviously, there were certain norms that were acceptable. In Australia today, there are other norms. In other countries around the world, maybe in the Muslim world, there would be other norms again. So here, the social context is actually all important for what is acceptable and what is not. And that is, again, it shows you the flexibility in these precepts. This precept, really, what it is about is whether you're hurting somebody. If somebody is protected by the law, if somebody is deemed outside of your kind of what is allowable sexually in this case, then that is enough to make it not allowable, because then you're hurting somebody if you transgress that boundary. And it's exactly the same in Australia today. There are certain things you cannot do. It will be deemed wrong according to law or social norms or whatever. And that is where the line really lies. An interesting point there about really the relativity of some of these precepts here, particularly this one. So that is how there are three kinds of bodily conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma: unrighteous conduct. I should perhaps say that, what I think, maybe it's good to talk a little bit about what is acceptable in Australia in the present day, for example, or the Western world, or in the modern societies. And I think the question, of course, arises, what about being unfaithful in a relationship? Because that is not really mentioned here, right? In those days in India, it seemed that if you were a man, you could have many wives, and et cetera, et cetera. There weren't really that many limitations on you in those days. It was acceptable. And that is why I think being unfaithful is actually not mentioned in these things. But in a society that is based on Christianity, and where we have the idea of getting married, you get one man and one husband, in a sense, you are going into a relationship where it's stated from the outset, it's part of the contract, so to speak, that you are supposed to be one with one all the time. So because of that, I think that the social norm in most societies that are Christian-based, at least, is that you are, being unfaithful actually would be a breach of this particular precept, because there is a kind of a legal commitment almost that you undergo the moment you get married to uphold that relationship exclusively. Yes. Kill himself. Okay. Right. Okay. Okay. That's interesting. Yeah. I guess life becomes kind of meaningless, perhaps, or yeah. something funny happens there. Okay. So that is the three types of wrong bodily action. The next one are the four ways of verbal action, wrong verbal action. And how, householders, are there four kinds of verbal conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma, unrighteous conduct? Here, someone speaks falsehood when summoned to a court or to a meeting or to his relative's presence or to his guild or to his royal, to the royal family's presence and questioned as a witness thus, "So, good man, tell what you know." Not knowing, he says, "I know." And knowing, he says, "I do not know." Not seeing, he says, "I see." And seeing, he says, "I do not see." In full awareness, he speaks falsehood for his own ends or for another's ends or for some trifling worldly end. And again, here you can see that the type of lying here is obviously quite a severe type of lying, where you are lying in the court of law or you are lying but when you are specifically asked about something. So what is mentioned here is quite a serious matter. And then towards the very end there, it says that you do this for your own ends, for another person's ends, or for some trifling worldly end. In other words, you're doing it basically because of greed or because of something, you know, some unwholesome quality inside of you that actually drives you to do this. So again, the motivation here is very important. And then he speaks maliciously. He repeats elsewhere what he has heard here in order to divide those people from these. Or he repeats to these people what he has heard elsewhere in order to divide these people from those. Thus he is one who divides those who are united, a creator of divisions, who enjoys discord, rejoices in discord, delights in discord, a speaker of words that create discord. So this is any time, you know, it comes down to talking badly about other people, really. And sometimes you can do it, you know, more or less, you can do it maliciously, and sometimes it's just like gossiping or whatever. But anything that sort of, you know, pulls people apart. And it's very natural for us to do this. It's very natural to say things about others that are bad, sometimes. Because you don't, if there's something you don't like, you don't want your friends to like that person. So it's very natural to say negative things about other people sometimes. But that is precisely the sort of thing you want to avoid. You don't want to, even though you have a bad impression of somebody, you try to be more understanding and compassionate and not sort of spread that around and make life difficult and just trying to break other people apart just because you have a difficulty. So this is the speaking maliciously. And it's interesting here that speaking maliciously comes after lying. So in other words, it's considered quite bad in this hierarchy here. Remember that in the Dhamma, these things are usually hierarchical. So what comes first is worse. What comes second is then the second thing. So speaking maliciously here is actually the second thing here. Then we have, he speaks harshly. He utters such words as are rough, hard, hurtful to others, offensive to others, bordering on anger, unconducive to concentration. I think bordering on anger, I don't really get that myself. I think it's more better to say here connected to anger or simply angry words. In other words, words that are angry. I think this is partly the point of this passage. And unconducive to concentration, I think it would be better to say that it actually leads away from concentration. There are many things that might be unconducive to concentration, but this thing specifically leads away from concentration. And it's interesting, why is it that this particular quality leads away from concentration? What about all the other stuff here? Aren't all of these things here problematic for concentration? And of course they are. Because this is all about virtue. These are all the things that do take you away from the Dhamma, do take you away from meditation, from the ability to focus on things. So all of these things are bad. But I think the point here is that this particular quality, harsh speech, it has a very immediate effect. If you speak harshly, usually it means that your mind is stirred up, you are angry, there's a lot of activity going on inside of you. There's all these things. And for that reason, right here, right now, you're far away from concentration, and you won't be able to be peaceful. You won't be able to meditate properly. These other qualities may not have such an immediate effect. You can probably lie fairly quietly, perhaps, and perhaps you don't. The bad conscience doesn't arise straight away or whatever. So they may not have such an immediate effect. But of course, in the long run, they will also, particularly if you do these things quite regularly, of course, then they will also have a bad effect. So I think this is the main point here. Unconducive to concentration is that it has a very immediate, powerful effect of taking you far away to the opposite direction where samadhi is to be attained. Then we have the last one. He is a gossip. He speaks at the wrong time, speaks what is not fact, speaks what is useless, speaks contrary to the Dhamma and the discipline. At the wrong time, he speaks such words as are worthless, unreasonable, immoderate, and unbeneficial. That is how there are four kinds of verbal conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma, unrighteous conduct. I think the last one here, I'm not sure if gossip is the best word to translate this. This is more about speech that is frivolous, speech that is meaningless. And this thing is about speaking at the wrong time, for example. You don't know when it is appropriate to speak. You interrupt people or whatever it is. You have no sense of timing inside of yourself. Immoderately here just means that you kind of the verbal flow just goes on without any end. And you speak things that are, it says in the Pali here, worthless actually means words that are not worthy of treasuring. In other words, they're not worthy of storing up. They're not really worthy of listening to. When somebody speaks something that is really meaningful, you actually listen and you take it on board and you sort of think, oh, I got to, you read the suttas, you think, okay, I should take this on board. I should treasure it. I should keep it in mind. It's something worth treasuring. But this is the opposite. It's a words not worth treasuring. And for that reason, they are considered fairly pointless in this scheme of things. But again, this is the least bad of the four ways of speech. And so because it doesn't really do any immediate harm, except for perhaps stirring up the mind a little bit. So that's the four ways of unwholesome speech. Now we come to the three ways of mental wrong conduct. And how, householders, are there three kinds of mental conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma, unrighteous conduct? Here someone is covetous and covets the wealth and property of others thus. Oh, may what belongs to another be mine. So this is greed, basically, right? You want what belongs to others. The word, Pali word behind this is abhijja. And abhijja, here it quite clearly means covetousness. In the sense of, kind of the biblical word covetous. It's not a very common word these days, I think. But it's like you want something which belongs to others. But basically, I think all types of greed are really included here to some extent. The most strong one is the coveting of other people's wealth, property. Or he has a mind of ill will and intentions of hate thus. May these beings be slain and slaughtered. May they be cut off, perish, and be annihilated. So this very strong kind of anger here. It was interesting. I was reading a report, I think, from one of the universities in the US. And there was some professor of psychology or something. And he had asked his students, how many of you have ever had like murderous fantasies in your life? Really, when you're sort of thinking about killing somebody. And it was an incredibly high percentage who had a murderous fantasy. I think something like 93 or 97%. It was above 90% anyway. So this is quite a common thing that people have. Sometimes, occasionally, you get this murderous fantasy. You get so upset with somebody. And you think about these things. Of course, for most people, they're able to distinguish between the fantasy and reality. So they stop at the fantasy and they don't go any further. But then there are some who, actually play it out and actually live this fantasy. And that's when the problem arises. And that's when you realize these sort of things, you realize you can actually have a sense of compassion, even with somebody who kills somebody. You can see the seed in your own mind. It's actually there. We all kind of have this to some extent. And when you see that seed, well, you can see, okay, I can even accept somebody who is a murderer. I can understand that, there is this potential actually exists in all of us. So that is a good way of finding compassion, even for the most difficult people, so to speak. So here we have then the mental unwholesome conduct, greed on the one hand, and then anger on the other. And then comes the very interesting one, which is the wrong view at last here. Or he has wrong view, distorted vision. Thus, there is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed, no fruit or result of good and bad actions, no this world, no other world, no mother, no father, no beings who are reborn spontaneously, no good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have themselves realized by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other. So this is a wrong view, and it comes last here. And the reason why I think it comes last again is because it, in itself, it is not necessarily such a bad thing. But of course, if you have a view such as this, it usually entails certain behavior. It entails certain way of doing things. So that is of course the real problem with such a view. It's actually what it entails. But the view on its own, whether what actually it does, it may not do all that much if you just hold it, but actually you're a really nice guy despite that. So what is this view all about? Well, basically, it is about karma and rebirth is really what this is about. And you can see here at the very beginning, there is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed, means that you think there's nothing to be gained from these things. You think, you know, what's the point of giving anything? It doesn't make any sense. You know, I'm just wasting my money. I can use it on myself. Why would I want to give it to somebody else? That's basically what it's saying. But I think, you know, this shows, in my opinion, just a lack of insight into your own mind if you can't see that giving actually is good. Anybody who has given something in their life, given something in the right way, they know that there is something to be gained from that. You feel happy inside after you give something. You feel a sense of joy sometimes. You feel a sense of lightness. There's something happening inside of you, which is exact opposite to when you feel greedy. When you feel greedy, it's like a, you know, the mind kind of contracts. It doesn't really expand. It actually is a sense of unpleasant feeling if you are greedy. But actually, giving is something beautiful. And it lifts your mind up. It makes you feel much better about yourself afterwards. Of course, part of the problem here is possibly what they mean is that there is no karmic repercussions in future lives. That may be part of what they mean. But also it may be simply a lack of psychological insight in this very life. So that is the meaning. That's why it's quite important to actually get some understanding on the psychological impact. Feel it for yourself. What goodness does to you, whatever way you're kind, what does it actually do to your mind? And when you see that, when you see it has a positive impact on your mind, it works in this life, and you know that that is exactly the same mind state that you also will take with you into a future life. So either way, you can't really lose out with these things. Then there is no fruit and result of good and bad actions. So this is denying that there is a law of karma, and neither good nor bad have any result. And of course, if that really is the case, then it's almost like a license to do whatever you like because it doesn't have any results. Even in a very simple way, it's obviously wrong. I mean, even the fact if you do something really bad, you can expect to go to prison, right? I mean, this is very, very obvious in our society. So even in the very kind of simplest fashion, this obviously must be wrong. But I guess what is really denied here is that these actually have results in a future life, in a future world. That is what comes next. Know this world, no other world. And know this world in Pali means the present life, and the other world means a future life. So here you are denying basically rebirth. You're saying there is no rebirth. This is considered wrong view then. Then comes an interesting one, no mother, no father. This is one that I find, I always wonder what that meant. I saw it in here for many, many years. I never really understood what it means, no mother, no father. Of course, you can see from the context here that it's very likely to have something to do with karma and rebirth, right? I mean, otherwise, because the context is really about karma and rebirth. But why is it mentioned separately? And I think once you start to read more broadly in the suttas, and you see the way that mother and father are often talked about in the suttas, first of all, they talked about that you have a great debt to them because they have brought you up in the world, they have looked after you. And secondly, you also see elsewhere that the kamma that you can make in relationship to your parents is very, very powerful. Killing your parents can take you to hell, according to certain sutras. In other words, call it enormous suffering, if you like. So the point here seems to be that your parents are a particular field of merit that is very, very powerful. And the point is that if you deal with your parents in the right way, you can make lots of good kamma. If you deal with them in the wrong way, you can actually make heaps of bad kamma. So I specifically pointed out in this way to, you know, to make this point. That's how I understand this point here. It's very kind of succinct and contracted. And then the next one, no beings who are reborn spontaneously. And again, it's slightly cryptic why that should be part of right view. What is the point of this? And I think the point is that when it comes to kamma and rebirth, obviously an ordinary physical human body can only take so much suffering, can only have so much happiness. You can't really, with this body, you can only have so much happiness. And the suffering is also limited, because if you torture it too much, you will just die. But if you are reborn spontaneously, if you have a mind-made body, there is virtually no limit anymore to how much happiness and suffering you can have, because those bodies don't really die. So they can sort of, you know, you can be mutilated endlessly, and you still won't die, you still won't pass away, because it is a mind-made body. It is a spontaneously arisen body. So this, what this does, it enlarges the scope for kamma to ripen in the future. And that enlargement is what is so important, because then you can certainly you see the bigger picture of what's going on, from the terrible suffering to incredible, incredible happiness that you can have. It's like an expansion. The human realm is on this tiny, tiny little span of happiness and suffering, and then suddenly you have this enormous field that happens. And that is important, because only then can you understand both the incredible happiness but also the horrors of this samsaric existence that we're part of. Okay, and then the last one, and this is perhaps the most important one of all in my estimation, that there are no good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have themselves realized by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. So what this one is saying, basically what you're saying here, is that there is no one in the world who knows more than I do. There's nobody who has realized anything. They haven't seen that there is a future life, that there is such a thing as rebirth. And of course, if you don't think that there is anybody out there who knows anything, you don't have any confidence in anybody. You don't become a Buddhist. You don't become anything. You become just like, we're all the same and nobody knows anything more than anybody else. And I'm not going to believe in any of these things. If you tell me that's rebirth, well, that's your problem. I don't think there is such a thing as rebirth. And of course, this is like the foundation aspect of the Buddhist path. You have to have some faith in the Buddha, in the Buddhist teachings, in that it is possible to develop the mind, to gain the deep meditation states, to see things in a different way. If you don't have that confidence to begin with, then it is virtually, there is no starting point on the Buddhist path. That is the starting point. And the way it is always explained in the suttas is that you go and see perhaps the Buddha, or you see somebody else who is very impressive, and you observe them. And what you observe is you observe something that is very different from what you normally see. You observe purity, you observe kindness, you observe peace, you observe compassion, you observe all these things that you normally cannot see in anybody else. And when you see that, you make the inference that the mind of this person is different from my mind. Just like we make the inference that people are, from external aspects, they look angry, so they must be angry. In the same way, we make an inference about the mental state of that person. And that is how we decide that somebody is worthy of confidence, that the Buddha is worthy of confidence or whatever. And that is how the Buddhist path basically starts, from that point of view. And it's fascinating. Why is it that some people never have confidence in anything? Why is it that some people, they come to the Buddha, they see somebody who, from my point of view, is very, very pure and very powerful person, just coming into the presence sort of, is almost, you become frightened, you want to sort of step away a little bit because you feel the power is so great sometimes. Why is it that some people don't have that sense and they just dismiss it? It seems to be that people have different kind of abilities to sort of feel these things or see these things. And if you don't have that ability, basically it means that you have very little chance of getting started on the spiritual path. seems to be a kind of psychological thing that blocks you from actually being able to even get started. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Bhante, it's very easy to a lot of people have difficulties with trust and trusting themselves and trusting the feelings that they've got within themselves. And your example there of meeting a great master requires a certain element of taking those deep parts of oneself, probably beyond language, taking that stuff seriously. And if you're not well with trust, either with yourself or other people, then you're likely to dismiss that and blow it right off. So, you know, maybe that's got something to do with why people actually can have really, even people that can help them in normal life, and they just, it's almost like they're emotionally anorexic. The help is there in front of them, but they can't reach out and have it and take it.
Okay, yeah. So that has to do with a certain maturity, in a sense, emotional maturity, perhaps, or
a couple of things. First of all, to recognise the internal messages within yourself, and then you're at a crossroads: do I trust this, or do I can it? Do I push it down and pretend that you know this is not happening, and I don't need this anyway? So the first thing is to actually have the antenna, and I think the second thing is to actually decide whether you're going to give it a reality, give it a meaning.
Yeah. Yeah, and I suppose also that it also depends on kind of our past experience as well. If you have past experience where you have been taken advantage of by some kind of teacher or guru, that's really going to put you off, you know. You'd be very kind of skeptical and very kind of, so there are probably many factors that have come into
how. Well, that's where the whole trusting thing is. A lot of people actually don't trust other people because of they trusted people when they were little people, and it doesn't sit well with them to continue that sort of thing because they've been hurt in the past.
Yeah. Yes, I think it probably depends a lot then on your kind of your psychological independence, for example, also the fact that you feel independent, that you can actually go there, you can just observe. And if you feel that, you know, what you're seeing isn't really worth of confidence, you just withdraw and you haven't lost anything. Where some people might go with the idea, oh, this will be my teacher, they will guide me, they will show me the path. And perhaps there's too much dependence in the relationship, which can be perhaps dangerous, because then if it turns out to be the wrong person, it's actually, you know, you suffer a lot from that.
Yeah, and what actually happens, that's right, Bhante, what actually happens is you get the ping-pong effect where, you know, people have this light switch mentality, I'll trust everybody, and it's on, and then you flick the switch, I get hurt, and I just withdraw and I won't trust anybody. And really the reality is that trusting is a dimmer switch, not a off-on switch.
Right, Okay, good point, Thank you for that, So I think this is actually one of the important things that I feel about spiritual life. In the end, you have to take responsibility for your own spiritual life. You cannot actually allow somebody else to point everything out to you and say, you should do this, you should do that. A teacher should sort of say a few things, a few guiding things to guide you in the right direction. And then you have to look inside of yourself and actually make decisions for yourself. And this kind of over-dependence on somebody is always, I think, a very bad idea. And this, I think, is one of the strengths of the Buddha's teachings, is that, you know, because the Buddha's teachings are still available, you don't actually have to go to a teacher to get all the teachings. That is not where you place your ultimate faith. You can place your ultimate faith in something that existed a long time ago, which is still, you know, you may still feel that it is the living experience of this is still available today, you know, in certain people. But the fact is that is your ultimate ground of confidence. That's where you place it. So if somebody turns out not to be the right teacher, you can discard that. It's fine. It doesn't shake your confidence, and you can still keep going after that. So you have a kind of deeper, there's a deeper measure here to that, to these things, yeah. But still, it is obviously very, very important to actually have that confidence, to have something in life that you feel is worthy. Otherwise, you don't get started on the path like the Buddhist path. If you don't see anything in it, you're never going to get started. There has to be something there which draws you towards this. And hopefully you do that in a skillful way so you don't get put off with these things. Okay, so there you are. And you can see the interesting thing here, the most important thing they talk about here that actually has to be realized is the fact that there is this world and there is the other world. In other words, there is such a thing as rebirth. It revolves around rebirth. The Dhamma really revolves around that, and the understanding of suffering revolves around that. And because of that, the whole thing really comes together around that. So when somebody you have confidence in says that there is rebirth, then suddenly you think, oh, okay, I've got to take it seriously now. I can't just dismiss it anymore. That's the right way of approaching it. I've got to take it seriously rather than just grabbing hold of it and saying it is true. And then you're on the right path. So these are the three kinds of unwholesome thoughts or mental conduct. And the Buddha then says, that is how there are three kinds of mental conduct, not in accordance with the Dhamma, unrighteous conduct. So, householders, it is by reason of such conduct, not in accordance with the Dhamma, by reason of such unrighteous conduct, that some beings here on the dissolution of the body after death reappear in states of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. So these are what creates problems for you. So this is the whole specter of things that you have to look into to make sure to make sure you go into a safe destination in the future. And then comes the opposite side, and that comes the positive side. Householders, there are three kinds of bodily conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct. There are four kinds of verbal conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct. There are three kinds of mental conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct. And how, householders, are there three kinds of bodily conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct? Here, someone abandoning the killing of living beings abstains from the killing of living beings. With rod and weapon laid aside, gentle and kindly, he abides compassionate to all living beings. So here you have the right side of the equation. So far we looked at the negative side, and this is what you should be doing. And as I like to always say, in Buddhism, it's not just about things you shouldn't be doing, also things that you should be doing. And here, basically, what you should be doing is you should be gentle, you should be kind, you should be compassionate to living beings. And of course, that means that's how you act in daily life, right? This is how we treat others. So this is part of the positive aspect of positive virtue on the Buddhist path. But what is the main point here? And what is the important point here is actually the motivation that lies behind what you're doing. The motivation here is that you're compassionate, you are kind, you are gentle. This is what drives you, this gentleness and kindness coming from inside. And this is what I was saying before. It's not so much, you know, the killing is not an absolute thing in its own right. If you can kill or you do hurt somebody, but you're actually coming from kindness, then according to this, it may not be such bad karma. And of course, this is where we come to things like euthanasia, mercy killing, is when somebody really wants to die, and you have done every possible test to affirm that their state of mind is sound and they've had enough and they are about to die anyway and they're terminally ill or whatever. And then they say, please, you know, turn off the machines or whatever. Then if you look inside yourself and you know that you're coming from compassion for that person, you're coming from clarity of mind, you're very clear about what you're doing, then the question is, how much bad karma can that be if you come from that state of mind? And the answer is that from judging from these kind of passages, it cannot be very bad karma. Perhaps it is no bad karma at all because you're coming from a good state of mind. But everyone has to know their own state of mind, whether you feel comfortable with it, whether you actually are coming from compassion, whether you are coming from clarity. But if you feel confident about it, you feel sure about inside of yourself, then you also know that the amount of bad karma you're making must be very small in that kind of situation. So this is the this is how, from a Buddhist point of view, you can see how, if you look at the first precept as it actually stands, you shouldn't be killing, then it seems that things like euthanasia is completely out from Buddhist point of view. But if you look at these sort of statements here, which are more deeply at what actually Buddhist ethics actually are, it opens up the possibility for these kind of things as well. And you may have seen that Ajahn Brahm has previously written articles also in the West Australian where he has sort of supported the idea of legalizing euthanasia in Australia. And that is based on these kind of arguments straight from the suttas. And then, of course, you can also argue about things like, what about abortion, for example? And again, the same principle again applies in abortion. It is why you do it is much more important than the actual act itself. Why are you doing this? Of course, with abortion, it's a little bit different, because with abortion, there is a being there that doesn't really have any say, that, you know, gets that actually dies in the process. The kind of the ameliorating thing with abortion is that if you do it very early on, then it is also a being that, you know, it's a very kind of, it's a very lesser type of life form. It's not a life form which can experience very much of the world anyway. It's more like something very small and very tiny. And that is kind of the ameliorating effect there. But again, it is where you're coming from is the most important thing here. And I cannot say that, you know, abortion ever is really a thing one should try to avoid, of course. But if the circumstances are such that one, you know, feels one has no choice or whatever, then at least look inside your heart and see where you're coming from, why you're doing this, and to minimize the bad consequences of that. So those are two of the kind of tricky ethical issues that people often talk about. So that is the first one of these three wholesome ways of bodily conduct. And then you have the second one, abandoning the taking of what is not given. He abstains from taking what is not given. He does not take by way of theft the wealth and property of others in the village or in the forest. So again, here again, we can, you know, you can ask yourself, you can bring up hypothetical situations. It's actually very useful to bring up hypothetical situations, because in a hypothetical situation puts things in contrast. You can start to see what's going on. And a kind of hypothetical situation, you can imagine a mother with a small child, and the child is dying of starvation. And then the mother steals some food, for example, for that child, because the child is about to die. And maybe at the moment of taking the food, she thinks, when I have the money, when I have the chance, I will repay this person again. So what sort of act is that? Is that a very bad act? Is that a theft in the same way as when somebody just sees a Rolex watch in the window and they want a Rolex watch, they grab it, you know, because they have a chance? Obviously, there's a very big difference between the two. One is driven by a strong sense of greed, of taking what is others with no idea of repaying it, or even driven by anger sometimes. The other one is driven by the idea to preserve life, and also that later on you will repay these things. So again, there isn't any absolute black and white. There's shades of grey, and only by knowing your state of mind can you actually know to what extent something is a very bad act, or perhaps even acceptable act in some stages. But of course, you have to be careful here. You cannot trick yourself into thinking that your mind is pure when in fact it isn't. You have to be very, very honest with yourself to make sure you don't actually make a mistake in these circumstances. So that is the second one. Then the third one is the abandoning misconduct in sensual pleasures. He abstains from misconduct in sensual pleasures. He does not have intercourse with women who are protected by their mother and father, brother, sister, or relatives who have a husband, who are protected by the law, and with those who are garlanded in token of betrothal. And that is how there are three kinds of bodily conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, unrighteous conduct. And I think the last one here, essentially, the main aspect of this one is that you are faithful to your partner or your husband or wife or whoever it is. That's the main aspect of this. Of course, the interesting thing here, which is probably worthwhile pointing out as well, is that this sexual misconduct in Buddhism has nothing to do with the kind of relationship you have, whether you are gay or straight or even other kind of relationships. I don't know what it might be, but whatever it is, it's nothing to do about the nature of the relationship. It's to do with how that relationship is, whether it's moral, whether you're hurting somebody or not. That is what it's about. And this goes throughout Buddhism. It's about whether you're hurting somebody, whether you're coming from defilement, whether you're acting in the wrong way. That is the only thing that matters.
Bhante?
Yes?
Would it be fair to say that precept, and that precept about sexual correctness, is really a precept about trust and betrayal of trust? I mean, is that the core of the issue there? The way that a person may commonly betray is through sensuality and sleeping with someone else.
Yeah.
But the essential damage is one of betrayal of trust.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. That is kind of the main issue here. But I think sometimes you may also hurt somebody else. I mean, certainly when it comes to being unfaithful, it is definitely the betrayal of trust, because the idea there is you have a contract. It's like a legal act to be married. You have a contract. We're supposed to be together. And there it definitely is a betrayal of trust. But in other cases, it can also be damaging sexual activities, you know, with minors, that sort of thing. Yeah. I guess trust maybe comes in there as well, but maybe in a slightly different way. Yeah. But, you know, the similar kind of issues or with, you know, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sure. Okay. You're asking about the Buddhist stance on abstinence and how this relates to the sexual precept here. Well, you know, from the Buddhist point of view, sexual abstinence is even higher, it's even a greater virtue in a sense than any kind of sexual activity whatsoever. And if you know, it's actually considered a virtue, a kind of morality. And the reason for that, I think, is simply because, as we saw before, one of the bad ways of mental conduct is greed and it's desire. So if you take away the desire, your mind is more pure. So so the point here is to move away from that desire, move away from anything that has to do with these things. And that is why it's considered a higher thing. But it's a fairly minor thing. And I know that in the suttas, for example, you have even people who are Aryas, who are noble ones, who had full insight into the Dhamma. They still have, you know, have a wife or a husband and still live an ordinary kind of married life. So it's not a very, you know, it's not a very serious issue, but it is actually an issue of morality, even in Buddhism. That's why you keep the 8 precepts on things like the Upasana days and that sort of thing. Yeah. Okay. So that is the 3 kinds of good, wholesome bodily conduct. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yep, is committing suicide breaking the first precept?
I guess a good question.
Tired of living breaking the first precept?
Being tired of living,
That means bedridden, you know, in the terminal phase of life.
Yeah.
And not enduring the last phase of the dukkha.
it is... in the suttas, there are a few cases of people who commit suicide.
Those are the...
Arahants. Yeah, it's true.
Which is why euthanasia is okay, because there are arahants who want to... That's allowing them to finish it up.
Sure. Yeah. So there are. But
dhyana.
Yeah. But I think the point is that there isn't really any very clear... You know, the reason why the Buddha says that in some cases suicide was wrong was because it says, well, they haven't finished their work, that there was more to do, right? So it wasn't right, perhaps. But I guess it depends on the circumstances. You know, if you are in a position where you can't do very much anyway because you are so completely incapacitated, there's nothing much you can do. If you are in a clear mind state and you feel that this body is completely falling apart, there is no point to this anymore... then there isn't really any clear injunction against suicide in the sutta. There isn't any way it says that suicide is wrong. It's obviously, again, something you have to be very careful with. You don't want to sort of jump into these things at the wrong time. But it isn't very clear that that is actually the case. I think, again, you have to be very careful. But euthanasia, voluntary euthanasia and suicide are very closely related to each other, of course. They're part and parcel of pretty much the same thing. But I think that because it isn't clearly stated, I think, you know, as long as you're coming from the right place, I think it might be okay.
It's just that for me, when I reflect on my own situation, so if I have enough, probably that's because I've aversion to the pain.
Yes.
That's this aversion.
Yeah.
Scary to me, you know, that
breaking
it after all these years.
But this is the thing. Even the arahants were saying, "Okay, you know, all I'm having now is pain. I've had enough of this. I want to make an end of it." So even the arahants had some kind of, they weren't really willing to endure that pain for no reason, right? So it is quite natural to have a bit of aversion towards pain. Sometimes people say that if I commit suicide, I'm not allowing myself to live out my karma, right? That's kind of one of the arguments. This is my karma, so because of that, if I commit suicide, I'm not actually living out the karma. But I think the problem with that argument, in my opinion, is that, first of all, the karma is very often related to just your station in life. You are a human being, so because you are a human being, you can expect certain things to happen to you. And one of those things is perhaps to be very sick and very in a very bad state towards the end of your life. This is kind of a common thing for being a human being, right? So because it is a common thing, it's not a specific karma that you're enduring. It's just an aspect of being human. That's the first thing. But the other thing, the other argument against that is the very fact that if things like euthanasia is available, that could also be considered an aspect of karma, right? It's a good karma that counteracts the bad karma. So you can actually make an end of something which isn't really worthwhile enduring. So either way, I don't think that's a very... I personally don't feel it's a good argument to say, well, you're not kind of living out your karma. I don't think that argument actually works. And I don't actually agree with...
That's quite reassuring, yeah. Because I believe that's quite a standard interpretation.
It is a standard interpretation. It's not found in the suttas. So for that reason, I'm not sure if it is if necessarily is right. Okay. So then we can move on to the... Oh, time is going very fast. So move on to the four kinds of right speech. And how, householders, are the four kinds of verbal conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct? Just before I go on, just if anybody needs to leave, please just leave at any time, because I can see now it's going to take quite a bit more time than the 1 hour we normally have. So please feel free to leave at any time if you want to do so. So what are the four kinds of verbal conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct? Here, someone abandoning false speech abstains from false speech. When summoned to a court or to a meeting or to his relative's presence or to his guild or to the royal family's presence and questioned as a witness thus, "So, good man, tell what you know." Not knowing, he says, "I do not know." And knowing, he says, "I know." Not seeing, he says, "I do not see." Or seeing, he says, "I see." He does not in full awareness speak falsehood for his own ends or for another ends or for some trifling worldly end. So again here, you are not speaking falsehood for another's end or his own end or trifling world. You're not speaking these things for sense of greed or for whatever it is that you want to sort out in the world. But again, you can see here that, how you lie is, of course, very, very important again. Why are you lying? What is the reason for this? And sometimes people speak, well, what about white lies? I want to protect somebody. You know, somebody isn't ready for the truth. And occasionally, perhaps, it is right not to tell the truth or even to lie about something because somebody is not ready. You know that it might cause them enormous suffering and problems if you do say something to them. And in that situation, perhaps it can be justified. But of course, again, if you can avoid it, and in most situations you can avoid lying, you can just remain quiet, or you can say this is not the right time to discuss this, or there's some other thing you can say, which usually is preferable, because often lying can have repercussions down the line as well. So if you can avoid it, it's always preferable. But if you do it for the right reasons in a certain situation, at the very least, you know, it is far less bad karma than lying, you know, for out of greed or anger or something like that. So again, it's a motivational thing. It's where you're coming from. Okay, then we have abandoning malicious speech. He abstains from malicious speech. He does not repeat elsewhere what he has heard here in order to divide those people from these. Nor does he repeat to these people what he has heard elsewhere in order to divide these people from those. Thus he is one who reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendships, who enjoys concord, rejoices in concord, delights in concord, a speaker of words that promote concord. So here again, you can see the opposite side. Here, not only do you abstain from dividing people, but you actually say things that bring people together. It's the exact opposite. So it's the positive side of morality here. So you say something nice about other people. You say something to make people understand each other. You say something that bring people together in a nice way. So again, a beautiful, beautiful speech there. And all of these things here really have this kind of opposite side to them. I didn't say anything about giving, about stealing, the opposite of stealing. But the opposite of stealing is obviously generosity. And generosity is treated so many places in the suttas. So that's probably why it's not treated specifically as an opposite here. So this is the good side of that sort of speech, bringing people together, creating harmony, creating a sense of good feel and trust among people rather than creating suspicion. If you talk negative about people, you create suspicion. I think all the precepts have a lot to do with trust, Chris. Trust is really something that goes through all the precepts. If you don't steal, if you don't kill, if you speak kindly, you create trust all the way through these things. Yeah. Okay. Then we have the third one, abandoning harsh speech. He abstains from harsh speech. He speaks such words that are gentle, pleasing to the ear, lovable as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by many, and agreeable by many. So here you have the opposite of the harsh speech, right? I find this very, very kind of nice. Words that go to the heart, right? Pleasing to the ear, courteous and desired by the many, that are gentle, and again, it tells you a little bit on how, it says a lot about what is the right approach to speaking here. Yes. Anyway, so the last one then is the abandoning of gossip. He abstains from frivolous speech, I would say. He speaks at the right time, speaks what is fact, speaks what is good, speaks on the Dhamma and the Vinaya, the discipline. At the right time, he speaks such words that are worth recording. That's what I was saying before. They're worth treasuring. They're worth like putting down in a treasure chest to bring out later on. That are reasonable, moderate. In other words, you don't speak too much, and beneficial. One of the, I think, golden rules of speech, and this is basically that the more you speak, the more likely you are to fall into one of these categories. A lot of talking is always a problem. And the more you talk, the more likely you are to lose your mindfulness. When you lose your mindfulness, you say something that isn't appropriate or right. So little speech is actually one of the kind of golden rules in the Dhamma. Don't speak much. When you don't do that, you're actually on the right track already. And usually, if you really do want to speak just on the Dhamma and speak on what is good, what is really worth recording, well, you don't speak very much if the only things you want to say are things that are worthy of recording, things that are like treasures, things that people want to collect. You know, there's only so much you can say if you want to speak beautiful ways like that. So that is, I think that is one of the golden rules that is very useful to keep in mind as well. So that is how there are four kinds of verbal conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct. And how, householder, are there three kinds of mental conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct? Here, someone is not covetous, does not covet the wealth and property of others. Thus, oh, may what belongs to another be mine. So here, you are abandoning this desire for sensuality, essentially. The coarsest sensuality is the coveting here of other people's property. But I think also implied in this is also lesser sensuality. You'll see that later on. And his mind is without ill will, and he has intentions free from hate thus. May these beings be free from enmity, affliction, and anxiety. May they live happily. This is metta. You're wishing other people or beings happiness. He has right view, undistorted vision. Thus, there is what is given and what is offered and what is sacrificed. There is fruit and result of good and bad action. There is this world and the other world. There is mother and father. There are beings who are reborn spontaneously. There are good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have themselves realized by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. In other words, you have a sense that there is rebirth. You have a sense that there is karma. It may not be an absolute conviction or absolute certainty. It's very difficult to be absolutely certain about these things. In fact, I think it is important to recognize that one is not absolutely certain. And if one isn't absolutely certain, one should recognize that and say, okay, this makes a lot of sense to me. I think it's right. But actually, I don't actually know this. And to remind yourself that you don't know it and that you are hopefully moving towards a state where you can actually know these things fully. Yeah, so this is what this is about. And then, so that is the right view aspect. Three aspects of mental bad or good conduct. So, again, just to recap that one of the main aspects of all this morality, and this is a very broad sense of morality here, is that what the motivation behind it is always important. Of course, when it comes to the mental conduct here, then the motivation by definition is bad because you're talking about greed, you're talking about ill will, you're talking about a wrong view. So these are basically equivalent to lobha, dosa, moha. Moha is like the delusion, and then the lobha and dosa. But in all the other ones, the actual underlying mental state is very important for the degree of badness that actually is incurred. These are not black and white things. It's either good or it's either bad. It can be very, very bad if your mind state is very bad, but it can be also maybe not bad at all, even if you actually do something which appears to breach these things. And then on the good side, you can do something good, perhaps even for the wrong reason. You can do, you know, you can, if you do something from anger and from greed, which actually appears to be good, even that can actually be wrong if you're coming from the wrong place. So again, the motivation, again, is very, very important. So all of these cases, what lies behind it is more important than actually the act itself. So the five precepts are guidelines, the very, very useful guidelines, because the five precepts, they say, okay, I got to be careful here, I'm about to break something. They are guidelines, but they are not like the final say in what is morality or ethics in Buddhism. Okay, so now we come to the conclusion part of the sutta, and it goes as follows. So in other words, all of what we've seen so far, this is the reason for why beings get reborn in a happy destination in the heavenly world. And then the Buddha says, if, householders, one who observes conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct, should wish, oh, that on the dissolution of the body after death, I might reappear in the company of well-to-do nobles. These are the kind of the warrior caste at the time of the India. It is possible that on the dissolution of the body after death, he will reappear in the company of well-to-do nobles. Why is that? Because he observes conduct that is in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct. If a householder, one who observes conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct, should wish, oh, that on the dissolution of the body after death, I might reappear in the company of well-to-do Brahmins, in the company of well-to-do householders. And then in the company, and so it goes on and on. Then we have on the next page, we have in the company of the gods of the heaven of the four great kings. In the company of the gods of the heaven of the 33, the Yama gods, the gods of the Tusita heaven, the gods delight in creating, the gods who wield power of others' creation, the gods of Brahma's retinue, and it lists a large number of gods. I'm not going to read them all out. I don't think it's necessary. These are the various. These are equivalent to the various jhana levels you can reach, etc. And then you have all the immaterial attainments as well, the gods of the base of infinite space, and all the way to neither perception nor non-perception. It is possible that on the dissolution of the body after death, he will reappear in the company of the gods of neither perception nor non-perception. Why is that? Because he observes conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct. So what this means, there is a great, great, a vast variance here between the different types of rebirth you see here. One is just an ordinary rebirth among well-to-do human beings. And then all the way to the beings that get reborn in the base of neither perception, non-perception, which is the most refined state of mind that is possible to achieve within samsara. So there's a whole vast range here. So what this points to, really, is that these 10 ways of good action we have just seen, they vary enormously depending on, again, your motivation, your intention. The more pure your intention is, the more powerful is the keeping of those 10 wholesome ways of action. And if you keep them with absolute purity, that is when you can start to look at these very, very high realms here. Because if you keep these things with absolute purity, it means you don't have any greed. You don't have any anger, right? Because this is part of those wholesome ways of action. If you have no greed and no anger, it means that you're ready for the deep states of samadhi. You're ready for things like jhana states. So that is why, actually, what we have here is a very broad range of good actions. It seems to just be one type of good action. Actually, the range is very, very broad. And of course, to be able to reach some of these higher realms, you have to go do even more. You actually have to attain the deep states of samadhi. Some of these states are extraordinarily deep and takes a lot of practice in its own right. And you actually have to develop even beyond abandoning the negative states that we have seen so far. You have to actually develop the kind of things like the factors of enlightenment and these sort of things, where you develop the mind in very, very deep states of peace and happiness and joy, etc., etc. So what really this says is it really goes beyond the 10 unwholesome states into also samadhi practice, etc. And the last one, and then it comes the last one here. And it says here, if householders, one who observes conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct, should wish, oh, that by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, I might here and now enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. It is possible that by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, he will here and now enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. Why is that? Because he observes conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct. So this then is the arahantship, the full awakening we're talking about here. And it's fascinating how the 10 ways of righteous conduct actually are connected in this way directly with awakening. Of course, awakening takes more than that, right? It takes samadhi, it takes insight, and that combination of samadhi and insight leads to awakening. But I think an important point is that if you really have a firm basis in these 10 right ways of conduct, actually you are very close to awakening. As it says in the suttas, if you have just the first jhana, for example, you are very, very close to awakening. You have a footstep of the Tathagata, you have the Uttarimanusa Dhamma, etc. You're very close. So by purifying these 10 ways fully, you actually are close to awakening already. And you see these things in the suttas. This is like the hard part of the path, purifying yourself to that point. And then the path is relatively easy from then on. But at least it's joyful, it's happy from that point. So that is really the foundation that we have to make. And then when this is said, the Buddha goes on. No, then we have this, the narrative goes on. When this was said, the Brahmin householders of Sala said to the Blessed One, "Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama. Master Gotama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the darkness for those with eyesight to see forms." So you see here, it's like the Buddha is often said to be like the eye of the world, right? And when you see these things, it's like the light gets turned on inside of you. So because you are the eye of the world, you show people the path and you turn on the light so they can see. So all of these things have to do with seeing things in a new way, understanding things in a new way. We go to Master Gotama for refuge and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha of bhikkhus. From today, let Master Gotama accept us as lay followers who have gone to him for refuge for life. So there you are. This is the Salayaka Sutta on the 10 ways of wholesome action. Are there any questions before we call it a day? Yes, Huitong.
Is
I mean, looking at the realms of the great gods,
yeah,
from, I mean, especially in the Jhana and the Arupa realm,
yeah,
can I, by inference, think that those are predominantly Buddhist realms? Because the meditation, these jhanas are essentially nearly fully Buddhistic?
You're probably right. They probably are predominantly Buddhist realms. I think it's impossible to exclude completely that they might actually refer to others as well. I mean, there are a number of suttas where the Buddha talks about his past lives and he says that he practices a lot of purity and metta and these kind of things, and then he gets reborn in the jhana realm. So I think it happens to others as well. But you may be right that these are predominantly Buddhist realms. Yeah, yeah.
If I flip the coin, put it this way.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. John. Yep.
I remember hearing a translated talk from Ajahn Chah, and he said, unless you overcome likes and dislikes, there's no chance of enlightenment.
Yeah.
But if you look at then suicide, that's really just an escape from the pain, isn't it? It's just an escape.
Yeah,
you don't want to put up with it.
You
want to have something easy.
Yeah.
Would that be correct? And then therefore, you're not really gaining anything, are you?
I think it all depends. I mean, sometimes we have to accept that we are not quite there, quite able to deal with these issues. You know, sometimes it's too much for us. If you are in a very difficult situation where the body is falling apart and all you have pain, and it may well be that your mind isn't that developed, you know, what can you do at that point in life? Sometimes, if you are an extraordinarily good meditator and you go into the world of the mind and you just enjoy the meditation practice, you can deal with it, then it may be right for you. But other times, it may not be possible for you. I think that is the first issue, that sometimes we just know, we understand our own limitations, our own abilities are only that much, and we can't actually deal with this thing. But the other thing you have to remember, that people are different. Some people are not Buddhist. Some people are atheist, or they have other ideas, you know. And then for them, it may not actually be any point in sort of, you know, keeping this going, so to speak, because they have a different view of the way things are. And then is it right for us to tell them that they shouldn't be allowed to sort of, you know, terminate things when they come to the end of their life? And this is another issue. Is it, you know, if there really isn't any ethical issues there with doing it, then perhaps it is right to just give people that option, a possibility to end life when they want to do so. It's personal choice, right? Yeah. And I think for Buddhists as well, I think that there comes a point, as I said, that, you know, basically you're not really able to do anything anymore. Possibly, anyway. If you can deal with it, and if you are able to use it wisely and skillfully, I would say definitely use it. Don't make an end of things if you can use it in a good way. Certainly not. So it really is a very personal choice. Am I making any sense?
Yes, you do, but it also, Ajahn Brahm always refers to bringing loving kindness to the pain and make it feel at home, tell it to stay around as long as possible.
Yeah.
And he's given many examples of how the pain's just gone by itself. And how, actually, he's given examples of how, or one example I remember him saying, of a person overcome cancer with that same attitude.
Yeah.
Now, the person with cancer could have easily determined his life, but actually went the opposite. Yeah,
excellent. I think that's wonderful. I think that, you know, certainly encourage those things as much as we can. So, you know, if people can do that, it's great. And you learn so much from that. And you actually, you know, it probably takes a long way on the spiritual path. So by all means, these are, I think, all very important points that you're making here. And, so that's all I can say really here. Okay, is there anything else that we have? Yes. You can dilute it. And this is the kind of I'll repeat that question. I can repeat it for you if you like. Can you undo nasty karma? You can dilute nasty karma. And this is that famous simile of the lump of salt. Have you heard that one before? Lump of salt. This is the simile found in the Anguttara Nikaya, where the Buddha says that your bad karma is like a lump of salt. You have the lump of salt is so and so large. Now, if you put that lump of salt in a glass of water, that water becomes very undrinkable and very, very, very salty. the amount of water is the simile for the amount of good karma you made, right? But the same amount of salt, the exactly same amount of bad karma in a big pond, for example, you can barely taste it, right? Again, so what you're doing is you're diluting the effect of the bad karma to give you bad results in the future. So you can't eliminate it completely, but what you can do is you can actually dilute the effect. So make, if you made some bad karma, make lots of good stuff, and then you'll be all right. So it's a good incentive, isn't it, to do some good do some good things in life. That's great. Okay, is there anything else before I... Anybody else want to say anything? Everybody happy? As you can see, the whole subject of karma is actually much more complicated than it sometimes seems. Anyway, so this is from Fernando in Sri Lanka. If the environment has insect that is causing illness, e.g. mosquito and dengue fever, then is it still bad karma to kill the mosquitoes? But the purpose is good because it will prevent your kids from dengue fever. It's a very good question, and it is one of those questions that is very difficult to answer sometimes. Is it bad? Is it good? And I think the answer is that this is what I would call gray karma. It's a karma in the gray area. Sometimes one of the problems with Buddhism is that we tend to focus on post-canonical scriptures like the Abhidhamma and that sort of thing. And according to the Abhidhamma, karma is either good or bad. There's no gray area in between. But if you read the suttas, the Buddha talks about karma that is both black and white, that has both black and white results. This is karma that actually is bit in between. It's neither completely bad nor completely wrong. And I think that if you are killing dengue fever mosquitoes because you have a sense of compassion for the people around you, that this is a bad thing, then I would say that is probably one of those examples of karma that is gray. It is not, you know, it certainly isn't very pure karma. You're certainly killing beings there. And if you have compassion for those mosquitoes, of course you don't want to kill those either. So it is a kind of a grayish karma. So the ideal way of dealing with that sort of situation is to try to find another way, of course, to deal with these things. And I know that in many places around the world, apparently they use mosquito nets with quite a lot of success against malaria, for example. So there are ways of doing it. But I can understand why people might want to kill these mosquitoes. And I would say that it is certainly not the worst kind of karma, because you're not coming from a place of hating the mosquitoes. You're coming from a place where you want to help somebody not to get these fevers. Gray karma. It's hard to say exactly where it fits in. That's question number one. Question number two is from Chris from Australia. Is taking medication that kills bacteria and worms in my body considered as breaking the first precept? Okay, well, first of all, you have to consider here where exactly is the line between a living being and a kind of something which is below a living being, like a bacteria or a virus, for example. And usually the standard in the suttas is that if something is a breathing being, that's what pana means. Pana means breath. So a panatipata, right, is a breathing being. So if something is a breathing being, if it has like lungs, then you would consider it as a being, not to be killed. A bacteria, I would say, I mean, this is all things that are subject to scientific research. You know, what beings can feel anything, what beings have consciousness, all of these things are very uncertain. It's very hard to know. But just taking it from the suttas and accepting that there are many unknowns here, if it is so small that it doesn't actually have lungs, then normally I would say it does not come under the first precept. So bacteria and virus is normally not a problem. Worms is a problem. If you have worms in your body and you kill them, yes, indeed, you are, in a sense, you are breaking the first precept. But of course, this is a time when you may want to consider breaking the first precept. There's a worm in your body, it's causing you enormous problems. As a monk, if I had a worm in my body, I might try to find out if there is a good way of getting rid of it without killing it. But some of these intestinal worms, they're completely dependent on staying in your body. As soon as they come out, they die, right? So I must admit, if I had a worm in my body and it was causing me problems, which they normally do, I too probably would actually break that precept just to get rid of that worm. I try to avoid getting the worm in the first place, but if it happens, as it sometimes does, I probably would simply because it's too problematic. And I would try to do it in as good a way as possible, of course. This is the thing. Yes, Ainsley. Yeah. Yes. Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah. But I suspect that is just probably all they could see, you know. They couldn't see beyond that. So that was so tiny. Okay, I can just see that one. Yeah. You're excused. Exactly. Yeah. That's a handy kind of criteria there for deciding. Yeah. Okay, sorry, yeah. So, yeah, Ainsley was just saying that in the Vinaya, actually, where it is, but in the Buddhist canon anyway, it says that if something is smaller than a bedbug's back, or actually what it says, I think, even down to the bedbug's egg, you shouldn't kill something. Yeah. So that is actually a handy standard, because then you know that if it's smaller than that, then, probably isn't a problem. But how big, anyway, is a bedbug's egg? Have you ever seen a bedbug's egg before? Huh? Not for many, many years. They are these nasty creatures, aren't they? These kind of blood-sucking creatures, yeah? Okay. Anyway, so that's, yeah, thank you for that. Yeah. So that actually is in there, you're quite right. Okay, question number 3. This is from Na in Adelaide. How to teach kids who don't believe in rebirth to do the right thing, like not killing insects? Well, what you have to do is to, first of all, there's a lot of scientific evidence these days that animals have feelings just like human beings. And you don't really need the scientific evidence. If you have a pet, you know that. They want to be happy as well. Everybody wants to be happy in this world. And so does a mosquito. Why does a mosquito try to run away if you try to slap it? It's because it wants to live, right? And the same thing with a fly, the same thing with all animals and insects. They want to live. It is just so obvious. So tell your kids that if you're supposed to be kind to human beings because they don't want to die, the same things apply to animals as well. There's a lot of work being done around the world on animal ethics these days. It's one of the areas which seem to be up and coming. But in a sense, we shouldn't make this absolute distinction between humans and animals. There is no absolute distinction. There's like a sliding scale, and there are animals that are very highly evolved, and there are animals that are lesser evolved. But because there is no absolute distinction, it means that we have an ethical obligation also towards animals, just as we have towards human beings. So remind your kids that, you know, they want to live. They haven't really come here to give you a hard time. They just want to suck a bit of blood. They want to live in their own way. They don't understand that they are hurting anybody. They don't understand they're doing something wrong. So just try to tell them that this is just compassion and kindness for the living beings around the world. And if there is rebirth, well, who knows whether there's rebirth. If there is rebirth, then you have an extra benefit on top of just being kind to living beings. Okay. So let's call it a day and let's pay respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.